Welcome to the Excellency Fiddlesticks podcast, an occasional foray into awesomeness. On today's very special episode, we look back at 9/11. Now, here is your host, Bish.
Thanks, Bridget. That's Bridget, our new co-host, our new announcer. And thanks for joining us, everybody. This is you remember on TV back in the 80s when you were a kid and you see something that would be called a very special episode, and there's always something really stupid. It'd be the one episode where you know Arnold's friend Dudley got molested by the bike shop guy on Different Strokes, or one of the cast members in a sudden reversal of character decided to try drugs for the first time, and everybody learned a valuable lesson. I'm sort of mocking that special episode concept here, but it's, as everyone obviously knows, yesterday was the 10th anniversary, and the anniversary seems such a weird thing to say of 9/11. And I thought it would be a good time to throw out some thoughts that I've had about the not only 9/11 and what it meant to everybody here and how it affected all of us as a whole, but just the anniversary and some of the things that went on yesterday, which to be honest, were sort of infuriating, sort of bothersome. So you dive right in here, and the first thing you think of is the day itself, but I like to go beyond that, and I think in the beginning, for some reason, I always felt this weird connection to the Twin Towers. I'm not sure why. I think it was when I was very little, they were in the process of being built. And when you're a kid, you're always into extremes of things. You're always into what's the biggest thing, what's the largest this, and what's the tallest building in America. And everybody said, well, it was the Empire State Building. And quickly, some smarty pants kids would be like, no, there's something new they're building in New York City now, which the World Trade Center is going to be bigger. So automatically, you're intrigued because it's going to be the biggest thing there. It's going to be the biggest thing around, right? And then I remember in, I think, 1976, I'm dating myself here, obviously, but we took a field trip down there and actually got to visit the World Trade Center and got to go to the top. And it was right when the King Kong movie remake had just been made, so it was a lot of attention being focused on them. I think it had only recently been 100% completed. I think they opened earlier, but they had not been 100% completed, both towers ready to go. And going up that elevator for the first time and having your ears pop on four or five different occasions, just going in an elevator and walking out on top of that observation deck and just looking around, it was fascinating. And even before you got there, being in the actual upper floors and you can press up against one of the windows and look down and see helicopters flying below you, that was freaky. And for a kid who's 12 years old, it's just one of the most amazing things you could ever see. And from that point forward, it always became something that every time I either went to New York or drove by New York, it was just something I'd always immediately scan the skyline and search for and find. And I always remember walking, anytime going to Grand Central and you'd start walking downtown, say toward Madison Square Garden or something like that, I always got to that intersection by the New York Library, and forgive me for not knowing the street names. I'm not the person who knows the city like the back of my hand, but I know where I am when I'm there. I'd always just get to the corner where the library is and just look to my left and look all the way downtown. You could see those towers standing there. They're always just the beacon in the distance. So I always felt this weird connection to them, and I'd only been there twice in my life and gone to the top, but I always felt like I had some sort of connection to the buildings. It was perhaps appropriate, apropos of nothing. I'm not sure why, but when you go back to that original day, and everybody remembers, of course, it's sort of like this generation's Pearl Harbor, I guess, or whatever you want to call it. But I just remember the main thing that it started out like any other day, right? It was a beautiful day. The weather was absolutely fantastic. Crystal clear sky, you know, just beautiful weather, early, late summer day, whatever you want to call it. And I remember being at work, and someone just mentioned in passing, did you hear what happened? I'm like, well, what? And he said, oh, I heard a plane just hit the World Trade Center. And you're like, well, clearly it's not a commercial jet because they don't fly down there. I mean, one of the few things I did know at the time was that commercial air traffic didn't really go down there. So my initial reaction has got to be like a Cessna or some sort of smaller plane. I remember hearing about a long time ago where a passenger had hit the was that the Pan Am building? The Chrysler building. Some other building many years before had been hit. And it was just, it's, you know, flight patterns have been different since then. So you just weren't thinking it was anything substantial. And this is about seeing any visuals on it, of course. And it was funny because this was like the first time I think the internet really came of age. The internet became the go-to source for those of us, you know, everybody's at work, most people. We can't get near a television. There was one TV downstairs, but I didn't even think to go down there because I had work to do. I was busy. It was a busy day. And, you know, by the time that all starts sinking in, you're starting to maybe realize there's something more to this. You start hearing talk about a second one, and you think, well, that's a mistake. Maybe it's people not grasping what had happened, and sometimes things get misreported, or people just say things without thinking about it. And you're sitting in an office environment, and we're just spreading around like wildfire. You have really nothing to back it up. But when you hear one, you think it's an accident. You hear two, you think, shit, this is, you know, something obviously deliberately going on here. And from where we are, we were in Connecticut, about maybe 30, 40 miles north of Manhattan. And on a day like that, you go to the upper floors of our building and actually see parts of the skyline. You could actually see the taller buildings, obviously, and we could see the smoke from where we were. And I was like, well, shit, that's pretty serious. If you can see all that smoke from here, that's a pretty serious fire. And I immediately remember trying to go to the internet for information and having the internet kind of starting to choke on it already. The internet was already being tested as far as, you know, the capacity and the burden we were putting on it. So you start thinking of going to other sites. You start going to sites and, like, you start going to BBC. Someone goes, oh, I know a news organization, you know, in India. Go to this site. And we're pulling in more and more information. During all this time, I'm getting phone calls from home, as many of us were that day. And it's my wife basically asking, do you see what's going on? And I'm like, well, yeah, I heard about it. I heard a couple of things, but still not grasping the scope of what's happening. But she, of course, is got the TV on, the news is on, and you've seen the coverage since then. It's all being laid out in front of her. She says, what are you going to do? I said, what do you mean what I'm going to do? I'm working. You know, that's New York City. I'm north of there. I'm fine. Everything's fine. Obviously, we weren't fine. And as things started to spread and people started to gather, and then, you know, a half hour later someone talks about the Pentagon, and we're like, what the fuck is going on? This is just ridiculous. And my wife keeps calling me, and I'm still just not grasping the urgency of this. I guess I'm not figuring it out yet. But it's you know, she's sort of indicating, you got to get out of there. And I'm like, well, we're not in any danger. I still didn't see it. I mean, even though I'm in a city in Connecticut, you don't know the scope of this thing. You know, there's planes up in the sky, and how many planes are actually, you know, targeted toward other things. But I'm like, I don't think I need to leave yet. I think, you know, things will be fine. I'm just trying to be, either I'm not grasping the magnitude of this, which is more likely, or I'm trying to be calm and reassuring, which is less likely. But I wasn't just getting it. So the calls kept coming in, and we're seeing the smoke, and eventually it's getting, as it gets later and later, and then, you know, we all did gather in front of the one television that we had in the gym, and you could see, and the first time you see that, and I don't remember your reaction the first time you actually saw the two buildings on fire. You're just like, holy shit, this is insane. And, you know, pretty much everybody in that room had known somebody who was either, you know, in that area, perhaps in the buildings, in the surrounding areas. We have with offices down there. The reactions are so crazy, you don't know what to think. You're hoping immediately that the people you know are getting the hell out of there, and you're hoping that the people who are in there manage to get out, but you still don't know the scope of it. Then, of course, with the subsequent collapse of the buildings, you realize that people didn't get out, and the scope of that. But at that point, it was funny because, well, not funny, but strange that people weren't even checking in with their managers. People were just leaving. So I'm getting the hell out of here. You know, there's nothing I could do here is as important as getting myself home. And somebody, I remember somebody passing me and said, "Well, what do you, you know, are you going to be okay? Because what are you going to do?" I said, "I just want to go home and I want to hug my kids. That's all I want to do. I just want to get the hell out of here." The problem with me, as you've heard on past shows, I'm a commuter, was then, am now. And I think my wife put the thought in my head, do you really want to get on a train right now? Do you really want to get on a mode of public transportation? I'm like, that's a great point. I don't know if I want to do that. So I start scoping out, looking for rides home. And if anything came out of there, if there's one story that was... one sort of funny story that came out of this, in the midst of all this terrible things going on, one of my colleagues who in the building, who was going my direction and was close enough, lives close enough to where my car was that would be feasible to get a ride home from her. So my wife calls back again and she's asking me, you know, what are you doing to get out of there? You need to go. And I'm like, yeah, I think you're right. I do need to go. I said, I think, she goes, is there anybody you can get a ride with? Is there anybody there who's going home, who's going your way? I said, yeah. I said, there's one girl who lives up by near where my car is, and I think I can get a ride home with her. He said, okay, well, go home with the girl. And I thought about it, and even in the midst of all that, I still can't resist the temptation to be a wise ass. And I'm like, can you say that again? She said, yeah, go home with the girl. I said, that's the only time in our marriage you've ever said that, and you probably ever will say it. And I'm going to, you know, if you ever say it again, we might have to get some counseling. But, all right, honey, I will go home with the girl. Stupid, but in a situation like that where you just grasp at anything. It turns out I eventually ended up not going home with her. I went home with another person who gave me a ride to my car, but... even the whole ride home, which is crazy. We were listening to, Howard Stern, and just everything you listen to is just that you just still can't believe what you're hearing. You still can't believe that those two buildings that were so just dominating on the skyline, and even architecturally, they weren't attractive in most cases. They took a lot of grief for not being attractive buildings, but there was something that had been there. That have been in the consciousness of people my age and younger since day one, you know, they were gone. You just didn't grasp the fact that they're gone. And not just that a couple of structures were gone, what they represented is gone, but the people are gone. And at that time, you're speculating as many as, you know, 40, 50,000 people could have been in those buildings at the time. So the magnitude of it is just too much to even fathom at that point. And even the fact that there was eventually about 2,900 plus people in there was just, that's still staggering, and still too many. But I remember getting home that day and just watching more coverage and suddenly just becoming totally obsessed with the coverage. I couldn't stop watching television when I got home because it's like the tribal drum of the things happening all the time. I could not stop watching it. My wife was like, "You really need to turn that off. I don't want your son to see this. Your kids should, you know, you shouldn't be watching this." And my daughter came home from school. I think she was 7 or 8 at the time, and she, you know, she didn't really know what was going on. They didn't tell the kids what was going on. They sort of just let them come home, told them, "Don't worry about it." Of course, we told her in our own, you know, in a try to make it as, I don't know how you make it, how you can't sugarcoat it. I mean, it was the worst tragedy, hopefully, that these kids will ever see in their lifetime. How do you sugarcoat it? But you talk about it. And I remember she just told me, she goes, "Well, I'm glad you weren't there, Daddy." And that was just, you know, that kind of hits you home. Hits it right where it hurts. And it's just all day, all night watching the coverage. And I remember the next day, what do you do? She goes, my wife's like, "You going back to work?" I'm like, "Well, yeah. I mean, you got to go back to work. What am I going to do? I'm not going to sit around all day and do nothing. I mean, as long as it's safe to go back, I'm going to go back." And it was interesting the next day. Now, I remember being a commuter back in 1993, I think it was. There was a guy in the Long Island Railroad who, you know, took out a gun and started picking off people on the train. Colin Ferguson was his name. And I remember being on the train the next day after that, and being hyper-vigilant, looking at every single person. If anyone looked the least bit suspicious, you know, you're zoning in on. And other passengers were clearly doing the same thing. Everybody was checking everybody out, looking for trouble. And you said, you know, this we're not going to let this shit happen again. Well, the day after 9/12/2001 reminded me of that, because every single person got on that train. It's the weirdest thing in the world that you all sort of are thinking the same things. You're all looking at each other. You're all feeling the same way. And you're all checking each other out. And God forbid somebody got on that train who was wearing a turban or was of Middle Eastern. And the natural reaction is to be like, okay, keep an eye on them. And it's horrible that we would do that, but you just weren't sure. You wanted to make sure you were being safe, and you figure the feeling in those days after that, and I'm sure everybody who was there remembers this. The fact that there was no air traffic in the sky was weird, eerily silent, looking up, not seeing anything in the sky, no planes, no nothing. When the planes came back, and when air traffic resumed, every time you saw a plane, you stared at it. You wondered, where's it going? You want to check, you know, is it flying too low? Is it at the right height? All right, we're clear. You know, it was just, it's hard to even describe the palpable sense of dread and fear that was going on at the time. Everywhere you went, in any open area, I mean, you're just looking around like, all right, we're looking for something suspicious. Do you see something? Do you see something? And it took a long time for that to subside. And it's true that people were nicer to one another after that. I know there's a lot of truth in that. People have commented on that, and the sense of American pride after that, and feeling that sense of trying to be united again. And the another sort of interesting story after that was probably less than a week after that, after the day. And I remember being on the train with some people. We got off the train, we're walking toward our shuttle area, and somebody bumped into somebody else or something like that, two other people, and you know, he kind of looked at me, he's like, hey, get the fuck out of the way, or something like that. And the guy looked at me, he goes, yeah, united we stand. I said, dude, that means we're back. When people can start being assholes to each other again, if it's safe to do that, then I think we're going to be okay about this, and we're going to bounce back, and everything's going to be good. But another thing that's even I can't figure out, even since then, I've almost been addicted to watching specials every year. And every year they start airing specials about 9/11 and start, you know, reliving. I don't know why I want to keep doing this and going back to this. Why do we do this? They're going to keep showing it every year. You know that. Eventually, even, you know, I think even 30 or 40 years from now, you're going to tune into something on September 11th and see some sort of special that goes through all that stuff again, because there's so much footage, and there was cameras everywhere. There's tons of footage about this, tons of stories. Some of the stories are amazing. The 9/11 special on CBS with the two French filmmakers who were doing the documentary about the firemen, that is one of the best things I've ever seen. I watch that every time it's on, because it's as depressing and just full of despair the whole thing is, by the time you watch it, you're filled with a little bit of hope. You see some silver linings in there where these people, you know, find each other, and they all survive despite this enormous tragedy in which they were right in the middle of. And I can't stop watching it. And I even started reading a lot of stuff about the so-called truther movement, but, you know, I can't even... Give me a break. I mean, I looked at all the stuff. I looked at a lot of websites. I listened to a lot of people talking about it. I remember when the day of 9/11 and subsequent days, you're thinking to yourself, and I'm a huge conspiracy theory fan. I like to read about them. I don't necessarily subscribe to a lot of them, but I like to read about them. And I looked at that and I said, well, here's one thing that you'll never get a conspiracy theory about this. How in the world is anyone going to give you a conspiracy theory about this? It's pretty clear what just happened. Not realizing what people are already thinking. And by 2005, there were conspiracy theories all over the place about controlled demolition and letting it happen and to start a war, blah, blah. The only thing I can say to that is the best thing I heard was on a special the other night on, I think, National Geographic or History Channel. So for this to be pulled off as a conspiracy, it would take probably thousands of people to be aware of it and to not say anything. And that's all you need to know. If there's five people in it, someone's going to talk. So I think this talk of a conspiracy is just I can't really indulge it. I think it kind of cheapens the memory of it. But speaking of cheapening the memory, the things that drive you nuts about it now are people who either try to capitalize on this, either politically or even worse, financially. I mean, you heard politicians who would always invoke it all the time. Hearing Giuliani say, if you elect a Democrat, we're going to hit again. I mean, that's just crazy. That's come on. That's cheap campaigning. But the thing that really got my goat about this was it happened yesterday. Now, as you might know, the New York Mets would, after the day after 9/11, or the first game back, which I believe was the 21st of September, in tribute, they all wore hats of the first responders. They traded in. They took off their New York Met caps. They wore caps with, you know, fire department, Port Authority police, New York City cops, EMTs, everything. They wore those hats in tribute, and they wore them for the rest of the season. It was a small gesture, but it was a good one, because it took something of a tragedy like this for people to realize how heroic and how important those first responders are, and how much we depend on them. I mean, you see the stories of everybody trying to get out of the building. They said, we just saw firemen going up past us, up and going up those stairs into that stuff. And so many of them didn't make it back. And you know, unfortunately, it took something like that for people to realize, geez, these guys are heroes, real heroes. And the sporting baseball players, like, we're not heroes. That's why we're wearing these hats. And they wore them for the rest of the 2001 season. And every year, on the anniversary of 9/11, they would wear the hats again. It's a wonderful gesture, and it was a great tribute, and some other teams might do it as well, but the Mets were one that always did it because of the impact on the community. A lot of their fans had such a connection to the tragedy and to the people involved. So this year they plan on doing the same thing, as they did every other year since then. They had the caps in the clubhouse. They were ready to put them on. And all of a sudden, and thanks to Ari Dickey, one of the pitchers who tweeted this, that the caps were starting to be taken from them as they were pulling them out of the dugout. They were taking the caps away. Why? Because Major League Baseball decreed that they would wear these special caps. The entire league was wearing special caps with a special little patch on, a little American flag. The special caps they were only wearing on 9/11. And they would not allow the Mets to wear the caps. To me, that was stupid. What's even worse is if you go to their website today, you can see that you can buy that cap for $36.99. So that's basically a huge, it's a money grab by Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball, by the way, has never missed an opportunity to fuck up something from a PR standpoint. And this is a perfect example of that. You take away something from the Mets who are doing a gesture they do every year, and it's a great gesture, and you literally pull the caps off their head to put on these caps, which you can then peddle to a gullible public for $37. It's reprehensible, and anyone who cashes in on this tragedy should I don't want to say should be shot, but it's just terrible, and it shouldn't be tolerated. But I don't think we should use this time to be angry. I think it's a time to reflect. It's time to, you know, never forget. I don't think anyone. Like I said, we're not in danger of forgetting ever because, you know, history's not going to let us forget. I think media is not going to let us forget about it. If you get a chance, go down to see the new memorial that was just unveiled yesterday. But more importantly, I'm not going to give anybody advice. Who the fuck am I? But like I said, just never forget it. And, yeah, I'm kind of sorry this episode didn't really bring a lot of the funny today, but you know, I don't think it was appropriate to do that. I think it's something we should all think about. That's about all I got. Like I said, if you want to hit me up on Twitter, it's at Bish24, bish24@gmail.com. And you can go to the website, or even if you're a Facebook friend, drop me a comment, drop me a line there. But until then, take care. Adios.